What I want to do in this meeting is to go through and look at the control of coherence and see if we can't get back to this question of when is noise refocusable, when isn't it? Or I don't know if we'll get to the when isn't it, but we will get to the when it is. So we have echoes, and there's no E there. I get into trouble. And I want to take the same model that we used this morning. So we're going to say that we have a field as a function of some spatial parameter. Where this is a gradient, of course, that is static in time. And of course, I'm going to look at this in the rotating frame. So this term goes away. So it's only this one I care about. And you might worry, be a reasonable thing to worry, that, hey, the Jacobian can't have just one term. What about the rest of them? But all the other terms are non-secular, so we don't have to worry about those. We'll just throw them away in the end. And so let's look at a simple pulse sequence. And we'll imagine that we have a sample over all space. And so I want to draw an axis that is the spatial coordinate. And after I give this excitation pulse, then all the spins are going to be pointing in the same direction. So no matter where I looked along the z coordinate, the spin would all be pointing, you know, let's say in the x direction. It doesn't matter really. But if I wait for some time, well, then, of course, the difference in field at each location makes itself known. And so the spin here is going to process faster than the spin here, than the spin here, than the spin here. And so this will get wrapped up into a helix. And so here, of course, what we're saying is that because we have this field, there's a frequency as a function of location. I'm going to drop that term. So it's just gamma dbz dz times z. And of course, since I'm allowing it to evolve under some time, there's an angle that is the frequency times time. And that's what I'm plotting here. And because the field is perfectly linear, the gradient is linear, then it gets wrapped up into this nice helix. And of course, if I waited longer, then the pitch of the helix would be finer. And if we have a helix, then you'll be happy to allow me to define a wave number. So we'll call that lambda, and so k is equal to 2 pi over lambda. So let's just write that as 2 pi over k. Just the wave number of this spin helix. Good. Now, this wave number, I can come back and I can relate here, right? So that I can take k to be equal to gamma dbz dz times time. And that's a nice coordinate to have, right? Because now it makes clear that k is in fact reciprocal to z, to the position. And of course, that's what we would like out of this. And therefore, I can also go and look at the same experiment again. And plot k as a function of time. And of course, k will just be linearly increasing. Perfect. Okay. Now I want to use this picture to look at the wide range of echo phenomena. So we have our pi over 2 pulse. And here I'm going to put a pi pulse. And I ask you to tell me, what does a pi pulse do to this helix? And one way you can think about this is to take each of the components of the magnetization. And of course, this helix is a helix of the spin in the xy plane. So let's just forget the z axis for a moment. So a pi pulse would do what? Well, if it's a pi pulse about x, then it takes x to x, and it takes y to minus y. So it takes the helix to? So it takes a right-handed helix to a left-handed helix. Yep. And so in the simplest of experiments, we can describe it exactly as this, that the wave number of the spatial helix returns to zero. And when it returns to zero, of course, that means that all of the spins are back in line with each other. There's no modulation over the sample. And therefore, we would get an echo here. This experiment isn't actually the first one that was done. The first experiment that was looked at by Hahn. So Hahn did this when he was a postdoc. So Hahn's famous for many things, for electromagnetically induced transparency. So he's the Oberhauser effect. He's instrumental in early ideas of coherent control. And after his PhD at Harvard, he went to Urbana, which was a hotbed of condensed matter physics. It still is. And he didn't really have anyone to work with, so he went down and built this apparatus. So here, and the reason these two pulses are 90-90 is that at that moment, it was hard to generate the electronics to give you two pulses at radio frequencies, period. Never mind to adjust the time of those. So we get exactly the same piece for the first part. What happens there when we give a 90-degree pulse? Okay, once more with a few more words. So the helix, where At this moment, I only care about what's happening in the XY plane. So what's happened to the helix? Okay, now I'm gonna insist you do it mathematically because you nicely told us you wanted that. So we have this helix, right? And this helix is e to the I kz. Now I'll put this k0 because it's a particular k, right? And here I'm describing this as saying it's equal to mx of z plus I my of z, right? Just to get a complex number out of this. So here's my helix, e to the I kz. And after I give this second 90 degree pulse, what do I get? So you want to change, put a sign, a negative sign here. But that's what we got up here, right? So if I think about this, let's put the 90 degree pulse along the x-axis. So if I put the 90 degree pulse along the x-axis, what does it do to m sub x? Life is good. What does it do to m sub y? Puts it on z, yeah? Therefore, what we're left with is now a cosine modulation along the x-axis instead of this helix. And then I say, let your mind drift back a couple days. And we did exactly the opposite of this, right? We said, oh, when I went to the rotating frame, I would take a cosine modulation of the RF field, and I would decompose it into right and left-handed helices. So now then we've taken this helix, right and left-handed rotations. We take this helix, and we're going to convert it into a cosine modulation. And if I have a cosine modulation, then I had better describe it as a sum of right and left-handed helices. And each of these would have an amplitude of 1/2. And so at tau, pretend I can line things up, I would get an echo again. But it would, of course, have half the intensity of the 9180 echo. And let's make a complete picture of this. So first, I hope everyone sees that. Don't be shy about asking questions, right? So that we've said, oh, I'm going to describe this cosine modulation as the sum of a right-handed and left-handed helix so that the Y piece drops out. And then, of course, I'm still applying this Hamiltonian to the system as we go forward. So everything still gets wound up again into a helix. And the nice thing about using this basics of the helix is that all I need to keep track of is the wave number. And so we take this one and we unwind it, and we take this one and we wind it. further. And then you said something really nice. You said, hey, the Z magnetization, the magnetization that was along V here, would go into the transverse plane. And that magnetization, of course, was along Z. It never saw the evolution here, right? So K is zero. And so there would be another term that goes right in between there. And those should be parallel. And of course, nothing interesting happens. In this piece, you know, we could say, well, how big is it? Well, it's pretty small, right? Because we've got that. So it's 1 minus e to the minus tau over T1. Right? It's whatever T1 relaxation occurred during that time. But, you know, we can solve Bloch's equations, and there it is. Okay? Good. Now, this is the magnetization that Hahn saw in his first paper. And then afterwards, he was asked to describe it in a Physics Today article. And he had a very nice picture. He's talking about this experiment. He says, imagine that you run a race and that you have a number of runners and they're going to run on a track. And you start the race. And they go at different speeds, and so they spread out. And then he says, well, what you do is at some moment you fire another gun that tells them to turn around and run the other way. And now they run the other way. And if they were running the same rate, they would all end up back where they were. Yeah. Here, in his original paper, Hahn publishes what is the magnetization at this moment. And let's forget this color line and just think about these two. Right? So then we can draw the magnetization and we say, oh, well, this piece is uniform, half the magnetization points along Y. This piece says that there's a helix as a function of Z goes as twice this wave number. And of course, remember that we took and put the sine term along Z. And so if you take all that and you plot it, you'll find that your vectors end up being on these two cones. And so you get this nice piece that says, oh yes, if I look over here, I'll see a signal that's half the magnetization. But if I looked on this side, I would see no signal. Fortunately, one, we don't have to draw these things much anymore. And two, if we did, Mathematica does it very nicely for us. Now, in a later paper, he looks at what happens if you have three pulses. And three pulses is the only other interesting case that you can calculate what happens if you have n pulses as a homework problem. I assigned that years ago at MIT. The students wrote it up as a nice publication. It's solved completely. But Here, we can take this k-space picture and say, find me five echoes, right? So two pulses gives us one echo. It'll be very easy for you to prove, if you want to, that any two pulses give you one echo unless you look at trivial cases. But three pulses give you five echoes. Now we know where one of them went. Right? We get this echo. Which is the so-called 90-90 echo. So now find me another echo. So everything here is linear. We're just going to apply the same rules, right? So this component by this 90-degree pulse will split into two. And therefore, here we'll have an echo. This piece will split into two somewhere down here. And we'll have an echo. The this magnetization that started here will split. And we get an echo. Okay, so we have four echoes, and I wanted five. And the most interesting echo doesn't show up yet. Where's the most interesting echo? Any idea? Remember that you go ahead.
From the business component as of the third pulse.
Perfect. So you said, look, this piece, we left some magnetization along Z. And since it's along Z, its wave number isn't going to change. So you know, this was the sine piece where that was the cosine piece. And now we're going to return it to the XY plane, and we will see an echo here. And this echo is called the stimulated echo. And it's special. It's special because it was stored along Z. And of course, along Z, the magnetization will stay for a time of T1, not T2. So therefore, along Z, we can make this time really, really long. And so we can then look at, well, what's the difference in the field here and here over whatever time that is. So if we say really long, John Watt, you don't know, but he's a hero. He did the first really hard experiments in NMR. He one day was talking to his friends in Japan, and he asked them, he wanted to do some experiments with calcium fluoride. And could he have a really nice crystal of calcium fluoride? And they gave him a really nice crystal of calcium fluoride with very few defects. They put it in his magnet, and 3 months later, it was still not polarized. But the T1, okay, it probably wasn't. Remember that at one point we said the T1, people thought it should be age of the universe because of spontaneous emission rates. Well, it probably isn't age of the universe, but you know, at some point when it becomes longer than age of graduate students, you give up on it. If we look at diamonds, we can have clean diamonds that are like that. If you, in the lab right now, we have a system where we have phosphorus defects in silicon sitting at 1 degree Kelvin. And the relaxation time, we can only keep it cold for about 20 hours. The relaxation time, it doesn't relax at all in those 20 hours. So if we created the magnetic field grating over the phosphorus sample, then we could make this time 20 hours. And still, the coherence between those two would be refocused and we would get an echo. And of course, the T2 of these compounds is very short, unfortunately, seconds. Okay. So those are all of the interesting echoes. We're going to look at these. Yeah.
I don't think you can reason that these experiments can actually be
Yeah, I should have already, actually. And, you know, it's a good picture right here that notice what happened. We created this grating. So we said, oh, actually, there's we haven't lost information as the system dephases. That information is written into the spatial degree of freedom. And it's only where you lose that correlation with the spatial degree of freedom. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. And for this, the early workers, you know, this is late 40s now. And of course, you know, electronics looks very different back then. Still using tubes, they were. They suggested that this could be a memory element and that you could build based upon various different K values, you could build a memory of whatever set of bits you wanted. And then by giving a pi pulse later, you could read it out. And so at that point where they had core memory, this was seen as a potential avenue for having smaller, more compact memory. And if you haven't seen it, you know, core memory is wonderful. You can hold each bit in your hands. So you can be glad it's not in your computer. But that's the resolution of that. Now there was there's a story I'd like to tell of a famous scientist, Das, who said he was Hahn's student, and he was the one who founded the Das Institute in India. And he said, well, if Hahn can see that, why don't I put another pulse? And so he had a pulse and a pulse and a pulse. Oh, I do have to get this right. He put the pulse here, and then he put the pulse here. And he calculated what he called the virtual echo, which when you added this pulse at a time tau, nothing else is tau. So let's call it T and delta, that you got an echo here at the time tau. Now tell me why you would reject this if it came to you to review. Yes. So it violates causality. And so that's in general a bad thing to do. He publishes it in an obscure journal, which I think is also a bad thing to do. that if you violate causality, you should publish it in Nature or Science, right? don't publish it in an obscure journal. And when you look at this, he has pages and pages and pages of algebra. And at some point, you can go through and find where he makes a sign error. And of course, he did not have access to Mathematica, right? So you know, I would probably have made a sign error, you know, hopefully a different one. But at least I tell myself I would recognize I had violated causality and I wouldn't be happy with the answer. The final thing that's really bad is he shows the result. And, you know, Das is a great man. He was never in the lab. So he must have, you know, browbeaten someone until they created the experimental results or something. But don't do that. You don't do any of that. good. So we'll get rid of that. Now then, we come back to this. And we've got this nice spatial helix there. And we want to know something about our ability to keep coherence in the system. And so what we're going to do is we're going to add molecular diffusion. So if I have a tube of water, the molecules don't sit still. And I can describe the probability that they will move by a distance delta z over a time t. And this will be 1 over the square root of pi sigma e to the minus delta d over 2 sigma squared. And sigma, the width, is the square root of 2 dt. And d, the diffusion coefficient for water, is 3 microns squared per millisecond. Okay. So if I wind the spins up into a helix, and let's just look at one component of that helix. Let's just look at the cosine part. So we'll say that we have m sub x as a function of z. Okay. And we have some wave number here. And now we're going to allow the spins to be displaced by this Gaussian displacement due to random molecular diffusion. And so we can calculate the effect of that. And of course, this displacement says that I should take every location in this, and I should spread that out over the Gaussian, right? And so all I need to do is to say, I'm going to take my helix, and I'm going to convolve it with that distribution. I want to know, well, what's the outcome of that? And fortunately here, this is trivial, that we can take e to the I k naught z convolved with this. And I'll just use the Wiener-Kitchen theorem to make everything nice and compact. So I take the Fourier transform of this, and that's a delta function at k minus k naught. And I take the Fourier transform of a Gaussian, and fortunately that's a Gaussian, e to the minus k squared sigma squared over 2. And of course, the Wiener-Kitchen theorem says, ah, I only need to multiply those. I don't need to convolve them. So it's much nicer. And of course, here I have a delta function. So we're just going to sample this, right? And so then we'll get this. We'll take the Fourier transform back. And we'll have the same helix, of course, but now attenuated. E to the minus k naught squared sigma squared over 2. And of course, this should make sense to you, right? That what's going to happen is we're going to spread in both ways. Here we're going to spread in both ways. And because we have just a simple cosine and I have this nice Gaussian, the result will be that I'll attenuate, but I'll still have the same helix. And the amount of attenuation is exactly this, but not in units that we like yet. So remember that sigma is the square root of 2dt, so that we get e to the minus k naught squared, the 2's cancel out, dt. So this is the attenuation if I have a grating, this helix, and I allow molecular diffusion for a time t. Yeah? Now, of course, in our experiment, it's not like that. K is increasing, right? But that's all right. We know that K is equal to gamma dBz dz of t. And so I can substitute in and integrate and have e to the minus d integral of t squared, there's gamma squared here, dt, 0 to t. And so the answer is e to the minus k naught squared dt over 3. And I hope that makes sense to you too. That if I wind up a helix and I allow molecular diffusion, well, I've got this helix there. So diffusion is always very efficient. But if I start without a grating and then I'm slowly winding one up, well, during the first period of time, diffusion doesn't do anything, right? Because there's no labeling of the spins over space. It's only effective at the end of it when I have a sharp helix. And so now then, we get this attenuation. So this is what I called A over there. Now we're set. It's not so good, my board management. I should have switched them. But that's okay. So if I take an experiment, let's do it like this. I have one pi pulse. Tau, tau, pi, there. I'm going to compare that to the experiment. Let's just compare it to the experiment. I need to get my timing right. That looks like this. So now I have three pi pulses. And if you look at these, you can tell me which one is diffusion most effective at causing a loss of information. Or if I look at the overall attenuation of the signal, in which of these two experiments do we see the most? All right, let's draw the K-space picture. Yeah, Why?
So that's the
explanation. Mm-hmm.
So it's an exponential, an inverse exponential goes to t. You have, I don't know, a longer time period in the course of
t. Yeah. So let's draw the k-face, because you're exactly right. So here, let's the one for the top. It goes up, it comes down, and it crosses zero there, right? And then if I steal another color pen. I'm not be able to see that. So we'll do this color for this. So it still goes up to here, right? But then it comes to here. And then it goes to here. So we have an echo sitting inside this. And then it comes to here. Did I draw this as a, yeah, that's okay. So I have an echo, then it comes to here, and it goes like that. So we get an echo here, I get an echo here, I get an echo here. But now you can see that I don't wind up the helix as tightly in this case as I did in that, right? The wave number is always smaller. And since the attenuation goes as the wave number. And in this particular case, you know, we know what that is, that this is K naught, and this is 1/3 of K naught. And so then I can say, oh, well, the attenuation in this case, is e to the minus k naught squared dt over 3, where t is tau, and it happens twice, right? It obviously doesn't matter whether k is positive or negative, right? It's coming in as k squared, yeah? And over here, well, this one is e to the minus k naught over 3 squared d tau over 3. But now I need the other 3, so it's tau over 9. But I have to say that it happens 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. And so then, you know, I can take out those, and you can see that this is much, much, much less sensitive. And then you can say, well, hey, we could put in some more pi pulses, and we could run faster and faster and faster and faster, right? And although molecular diffusion, we're not refocusing molecular diffusion, right? Molecular diffusion is going on just as it normally would. So we're not removing the physics of molecular diffusion. What we're doing is separating that physics from having any impact on the coherence of the system. So there's still this random motion. There still is a Hamiltonian that would correlate that random motion to the spin degree of freedom. But by modulating it very quickly, even though it's random, we can limit its influence in this. Yeah? Okay. So we see that we have some control over things. I'm going to skip a lot. And now I want to look in a bit more generality. There I said I had diffusion. But let's just take the location of the spin, to be a power series. Right? So we have the spin location as a function of time is going to be some location. It'll have some velocity, it'll have some acceleration, it'll have some jerk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? That's a very general piece. And now we look at the experiment where I apply a 90-degree pulse to the spins, and then I'm going to apply a yet-to-be-defined gradient as a function of time. So I'm going to take that term up there, dBz dz, and that comes from a coil that I put a current in. And so I'm going to control that current. I'm going to make that field time-dependent. And then I want to ask, well, what is the phase? Just like the phase we have in the helix, what's the phase as a function of time? And that is going to be the integral of the gradient as a function of time times the position as a function of time integrated over time. Yeah, that's easy. But now I want to say, oh, look, this thing's under my control. So let's write it out in terms of moments. Oh, and I need a gyromagnetic ratio there. So this thing is going to be the gyromagnetic ratio times Z0, that's just a constant, the integral of G of T dt plus Z1, the integral of G of T times t right. So now then, instead of having an expansion as a power series, I have an expansion in terms of moments, not of the motion, but moments of the gradient field. So then we look at saying, ah, I want an experiment that sees all of these. And so if I took G of T, and I simply turned it on and turned it off after some time, right? Then that's going to code for Z0, Z1, dot, 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 Z infinity. But if I don't want to see this, I want to code just for the velocity. I want to suppress the position. Well, that's okay, right? All you need to do is make this integral zero. And that integral is just the area of... So if I apply my gradient with this shape, then I'll code for the velocity and the higher order terms in the power expansion. But Z0, so we get velocity, acceleration, but the position, Z0, is not coded. So the signal that we would acquire has no record of where the spin was, but it knows how fast it was moving. And then if you've seen moments before, which you must have, then you know what the answer is for the rest of it. So if I take the next in the binomial series, then the binomial coefficients, and this will code for the acceleration, etc., but not for Z0, so not for the position and not for the velocity. And of course, you know, we can write them all down. And of course, you know, digging up your copy of Pascal's triangle is not the only way of solving this, right? But it's a trivial and fun way. And so here we say, oh yes, regardless of what I would describe the spins as, moving in the magnetic field. You think, well, if the spins are moving in a magnetic field, that's got to be bad, right? That's screwing up our coding. But regardless of what that looks like, we can find a sequence that will remove the influence. It just gets more and more painful as we continue on. And so, you know, we can, if we have an idea about what the dynamics looks like, then there are very well-structured ways of going in there and saying, oh yes, let's bring the coherence back. Let's not allow this sort of dynamic to mess up the coherence of our nice qubit system. Okay? So maybe I'll stop there. I will say that, one, these things are used a lot in MRI. So if I want to get an image of the velocity going through an artery to the brain, then we can do that. We can image the artery, but we can also code for the velocity, and we can see, is this a nice laminar flow, or, you know, is there something against the wall that's leading this to be turbulent? You can also see that you could, in general, try to measure turbulence just by removing all of these things and looking at a high-order moment and say, okay, if the flow is nice, these high-order moments should not have a lot of weight. And you can go ahead and look at those too. And this finally raises a nice question of saying, well, we want to make quantum devices. You know, is this the quantum device we want to make? And of course, it's been around for a long time. And on the one hand, you know, we can show that, yes, it's a quantum device. And of course, it's a little bit, you need to be a little bit careful, because the Bloch equation says that anytime you have one spin, one half particle, if you're looking at only the expectation values, and you're looking in only the limit of weak measurements, that there's nothing uniquely quantum mechanical about the outcomes. Okay? But if we have more than one particle, or we allow ourselves to look at more interesting experiments than those that I just limited it to, then we can see that it's uniquely quantum mechanical. But of course, one qubit doesn't allow us to bring in the power of quantum mechanics that we want to use for quantum devices. And so we'll, on Monday, look at what we can do as we add more qubits than just one. Okay, questions? And then we stop.